This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We live in a tell-all culture, whether in a high-profile memoir like Scott McClellan's insider account of his time at the White House, in a magazine article, on a blog, or in an email blast. Many of us have moments when we get so angry at our colleagues and bosses we want to tell the world, blow the whistle, set the record straight, explain why we did it, whatever it was. But what happens when you really do it and name names? Yesterday, Dan Bartlett, one of Scott McClellan's former bosses, said the one-time Bush loyalist and White House press secretary had just lost all the friends he ever had. We're talking with people today who told all about their workplaces, why they did it, and about what happened afterwards. Their worlds happen to be politics and the military and private education. But what about you? Have you ever written about your boss or the iniquities of your industry on a blog or in a first-person story? What did it cost? In retrospect, was it worth it? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, how men can get out of taking their significant others to the ultimate chick flick this weekend. But first, telling all and what happens later. Our first guest today is Alan Raymond. He's a former Republican insider. His tell-all, How to Rig an Election, chronicles his role in jamming phone banks in New Hampshire's 2002 Senate race. And he's with us here in Studio 3A. And thanks very much for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And why did you write this?
Well, I wrote the book because I felt I had to as a parent, as a father. I have two children, and I felt like what I had done wound up being a transgression of the law. I paid a very heavy price, and someday I was going to have to answer that to my children as I'm going along and trying to teach them how to be good citizens and good students and that type of thing. So I felt like this was the best way to put it on record. And so when they got older, if they asked me any questions, I could just hand them the book and then they could read it and come back and ask me some questions. So that was where my obligation came from.
You could have told your children in a scrapbook or a private document. You decided to publish a book.
Well, then it evolved from there. And I felt like, you know, there are some lessons to be learned here. There's some things I can contribute to the public domain that is worthwhile. And so for me, it was bringing, there's an old quote by, a very well-known quote by Justice Brandeis, which is, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so I felt like here is a place, an opportunity for me to provide a little bit of sunlight, maybe disinfect the process a little bit, and do my part for making up for my own transgressions.
And you also decided not simply to confess and explain what you had done, but who told you to do it and who you were working with?
Well, that's very important. In fact, that's where I drew the line. Some people write tell-all books, and that's where they draw their line. They decide, well, I need to disclose what happened. I actually drew the line when our government came and asked me what had actually happened. So I felt I'm not going to even consider being part of a cover-up or not having this disclosed. I was going to be fully transparent and candid, and so that's where I drew the line.
I guess there are prices to any of those decisions. The book was not published not all that long ago, but so far, what's been the fallout?
Well, on a personal level, there's maybe one or two people I knew from politics who'll have anything to do with me. To everybody else, I'm a turncoat. To everybody else, I should have fallen on my sword, taken full responsibility. And those are the folks who are still vested. Politics is a business. So the folks who are still in the game, in the profession, are certainly going to point to people like me and say, you know, those are the anomalies. These are bad people. They're motivated by greed. But the truth of the matter is, for instance, you mentioned Scott McClellan. If he was truly motivated by greed, he could make far more money working within the system and keeping his mouth closed than he could by publishing with Public Affairs.
And presumably the same would have gone for you, too, if you'd been a good soldier.
Probably I could imagine I could have come back and made my inroads back into the party. But at that point, the way things had gone for me, I just didn't have any interest in it. I didn't want to be a Republican. I didn't want to work in Republican politics anymore. So for me, it was a very easy choice because I had, I felt, one, the obligation, and two, it's kind of like that old saying, why would I want to be a member of this country club type of thing.
And in retrospect, you did the crime, you did the time, and now you've explained why to your children and to the American public and anybody who wants to go and buy a copy of your book. Was it worth it?
Writing the book?
Yeah.
Very much so, because I got to put on paper and then distribute to the public at large how politics works. I got the opportunity, like, for instance, today, to talk about the fact that politics is a business, what people should be looking for through the election season. It's a business, very high stakes, a lot of power, a lot of money at stake, and a lot of people are going to be up to no good. And so I felt like this was an opportunity to, again, pull the curtain back and say, this is how the process works, educate the reader, who's also a voter, so that they could understand the process as they themselves went through it and had to make their own choices.
And in the process of writing a book, doesn't that make you a little bit more reflective about what you did? I mean, your decisions were made in the moment. They presumably weren't the result of sitting around for several hours a day in front of a computer screen. When you see the words on paper, it's different, isn't it?
It's completely different when you have to put the words. I mean, the process itself of putting the words on paper demands some self-examination, some reflection. You're right. These decisions get made on the fly very quickly and all in the context of winning and usually winning at all costs. So the process of going through the writing the book, you're right, is very reflective, and from that enriches it and actually makes it, gives it its true value.
And I wonder, one other question, working with an editor on your book, was there any pressure to say, oh, come on, didn't you get a call from the president himself about this?
You know, there's always that pressure, but that's the pressure of making sure that if you're going to do this, you might as well do it right. Do it right. Do it right the first time. Don't hold back. And I think that, again, my compliments to Scott McClellan. I think that he's been labeled a disgruntled former employee. I'd just say he's a disgruntled American, and he's actually, maybe it's a little bit too late, some people might say, but I commend him for the courage of doing what he's done, because I've gone through that process myself.
Let's get Francis on the line. Now, Francis is calling us from Mount Shasta in California.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I blew the whistle on the U.S. Forest Service for logging spotted owl groves in violation of the Endangered Species Act.
And what happened?
Well, first they tried to fire me, then they tried to discredit me, then they tried to debunk me, then they tried to deny me, and the Government Accountability Project lawyers took on my case and saved me.
And saved you, saved your job?
Temporarily. I was eventually forced to retire.
And
I just retired recently after exposing a case where they were getting legalized kickbacks in order to log those places where they shouldn't be logging.
Nevertheless, even keeping your job, it must have been extremely uncomfortable at work.
Uncomfortable is hardly the word for it. I had lots of health damages and was socially ostracized within the organization.
And do you think what you did made it worth it?
Well, considering my health damage and the death threats that I got from within the Forest Service for doing that, I don't think it was really worth it when I look back on it. But it did expose a lot of the stuff that was going on.
And are you going to be able to make a living in your chosen profession from now on?
No, I've got 35 years in, so I've retired and I've got a pension. They can't touch me now.
Well, good luck to you. Thanks for the phone call, Francis.
You're welcome.
And I guess that same question to you, Alan Raymond. Do you see yourself returning to politics in the future, or are those bridges burned forever?
Those bridges are burned forever, and I'm very comfortable with that. There's actually some satisfaction in my instance of being able to be the vehicle, the instrument by which some of this disclosure has gone on. I found some satisfaction in that. And so I don't want to go back to politics. It is a tough business. And not to say that everyone in politics is bad. There's not. They're not. I mean, there's many folks would never do many of the things that I did recurrently throughout my career. But having said that, you know, I have no interest in. It is true. You do when the chips are down, you find out who your friends are. And that's in itself. There's some value there, too.
Alan Raymond, thanks very much for coming in today.
Well, thank you. You're welcome.
Alan Raymond, a former Republican insider, the author of How to Rig an Election. He was kind enough to come in today to Studio 3A. Nathan Sassaman was a celebrated officer in the U.S. military from 2003 to 2004. He led more than 800 soldiers in the Sunni Triangle in Iraq. But his military career all but ended when he was reprimanded after he covered up the actions of two of his soldiers who forced two Iraqis to jump into the Tigris River, one of them allegedly drowned. After he retired from the military in 2005, he, along with co-author Joe Layden, wrote a memoir called Warrior King, The Trial and Betrayal of an American Commander in Iraq. And he joins us now from Pan Studios in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And nice to have you on the program today. And we're having a little trouble with the line, hearing Nathan Sussman Let's see if we can hear him again. Nathan Sussman, are you there? I can barely hear you. It's just a distant electronic whisper. I hope you can hear me.
I can hear you clearly, sir.
There we go. We just got it. We just broke through. So you're on the air now, and thanks very much for coming in.
No worries, sir. Thanks.
You're a West Point graduate. You served in the Army almost 20 years, I guess. It must have been difficult to write a book that criticizes the military.
Yes, sir. And it's not like the entire book is a criticism of the military. And I never wanted to be portrayed as one of those persons that work in an organization for 20 years and then, you know, and then turn on it. I felt like there's just an obligation for someone that was, you know, on the battlefield, leading soldiers in combat, to kind of lay out the good, the bad, and the ugly, and hope that it will help future leaders, specifically, you know, platoon leaders on the ground, to survive the first contact in the fight.
And that's why you decided to write it, to instruct future generations of soldiers.
Well, I took quite a bit of criticism and became somewhat a persona non grata for my final year in the military once we returned from Iraq. And there was a lot of things written about me. And I think, like your first guest, I felt like I had an obligation originally to write something for my family and friends. But then it evolved into something much larger. I received encouragement from general officers and senior military officers to really have a social and moral obligation to lay out, you know, the decisions that were being made above me, and how, you know, poor decision making and cowardly actions are unacceptable, and those leaders should be held accountable.
Well, stay with us if you would, Nathan Sussman. We'll take calls after a short break. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. Email us talk@npr.org. Have you ever named names about your colleagues at work, and was it worth it? I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about the price of the tell-all memoir. Scott McClellan's cost $27.95. It cost him a lot of his friends, too. In our show-all, tell-all culture, the shelves are lined with memoirs, apologies, and expose. His is hardly the first. Our guest right now is Nathan Sussman. His memoir is called Warrior King, The Trial and Betrayal of an American Commander in Iraq. We want to hear from you. Have you ever written about your boss, your colleagues, on a blog or in a first-person story? What did it cost, and was it worth it? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can also share your story on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. And Nathan Sussman, let me ask you, you'd already been reprimanded for your actions in Iraq, which meant effectively your career was over. You'd already resigned from the military. Has there been an additional price, do you think, to then writing about this in a book that named names?
Well, I think the price is that you try and honor those that you served with, and you feel like you're telling a story to honor folks, and different people see the book from different perspectives. And I think there are some unrelated consequences that you write something very good about someone, you try and honor them, but the family members or the person themselves feel like you've degraded them, you know, and are very, you know, upset about it. And then I think there's the flip side. Folks that you think may be very angry with some of the things you've said turn out to be okay with it. And so I think there are some unintended consequences that happened because of that.
I wonder, did it, again, you were in the moment under incredible stress during your year in Iraq. As you sat down at a typewriter, or I guess a word processor, and went through this, did it look different?
Well, initially, the initial chapters and the initial drafts were very angry, and, you know, you're just getting everything out. You're right. I was in the moment. Lives were hanging in the balance, and as a ground commander who understood the context of the environment, I was doing the very best I could to accomplish the mission and save the men and women that I was, you know, charged with taking care of. And so there were very, very practical reasons why I differed from my immediate boss on how to handle situations and to make decisions in the heat of the moment. I think upon reflection, there is times when you wish things had gone a little differently, and I'm certainly – I feel that way. But when you're – when lives are in the balance, there's no time for retrospect. You have to make the decision, move on.
And have to make the decision. And anybody who's ever been under any stressful decision-making circumstances understands you're going to be wrong. Some of the time, you're going to be wrong. Nobody bats a thousand.
Right. And you would hope that it's not a zero-defect environment. But, you know, in the case of the military and the traditions and just how it's – how the beliefs are set up, you know, I stood up for the beliefs. I disagreed with my superior officers on how a number of situations should have been handled, and I paid the price for that.
And you've been I don't think scathing is too strong a word to use about your specific officers, who still serving officers.
Right. I mean – you're right. I mean, I think, like I said before, you know, senior officers, senior military leadership need to be held responsible, need to be held accountable for their decisions. And so I laid it out as I saw it. I was very frustrated. I received conflicting guidance, one from my immediate superior and then from my commanding general. And I was left to sort out which path to take. And then also I needed to take into account the accomplishment of the mission and the protection of my men.
And strangely, both of those officers continue, as far as I know, their careers progress very well in the U.S. Army.
And that's exactly right. I just that's how it is. And so there's, you know, there's perhaps no fallout for them, but for me, I needed to come clean and set the record straight for what I went through, and hopefully put the reader in my shoes. And challenge them to decide, you know, what kind of decisions they would have made.
Some might believe that you owed an apology for not telling your superiors what actually happened on the night in question. Your testimony, though, in your book are hardly apologies.
I wish we could have all gotten together in a room and talked about it. I still feel that the men who were with the detainees that night had no criminal intent. Poor judgment, shaky decision making there for certain. I just cannot bring myself, nor have I seen any proof to show that there was any criminal intent to hurt the Iraqi detainees. And based in the context of the fight that we were in, with losing American men and women, with losing at that time Iraqi Civil Defense Corps policemen, and losing American contractors, this by comparison seemed to pale.
You then chose not to tell your superior officer, who you did not trust at that moment, the entire truth. Can the Army – that's also the chain of command. Can an Army office – can an Army stand a situation where officers don't tell their superiors what they need to know?
Right. And that's – you really can't. And that's why there really needs to be a really positive command climate. But early on, the trust between myself and my brigade commander broke down. Through numerous instances on how to fight the battle. And for instance, one directive was you must drive on the shoulder of the road. Drive down the side of the road to allow Iraqi traffic to pass you by. And after you experience the maiming and wounding of your soldiers by that action, you know that that's incorrect. And you need to dominate the battlefield and drive down the middle. And so out of respect for the men and to do the right thing, to preserve the force, you know, we drove down the middle of the road, and that's just one small example where we differed. And over time, it just got worse and worse. And you're right. I did not trust my brigade commander.
Let's get a caller on the line. This is David. David with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Yes.
Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
All right. Thank you. I retired from the Air Force, and from early times, I took women to equal opportunity because they were being harassed. That action got me in trouble with the person that was harasser, who was my superior. I got in trouble. I was threatened with a bad conduct discharge. Because of punishment, I was being put on night shift and told I could not attend certain civilian things. And this is in California, in 1978. I was threatened when I was telling my captain about how our boss was running the shift and how he was overriding I was the shift supervisor, how he was overriding my command, and he kept me out of officer training. So, you know, I, all through my military career, telling on a superior, telling on equals and even people who were under me who were the golden boys, did no good and got me into hot water. I retired as an E6 because of, and with minimal quality, minimal ratings on my reporting.
Any regrets, do you think? Do you wander back and say, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done that?
No, I feel like I should. Well, yeah, I feel like I should have tried harder. But I also feel like they should. I didn't know what else to do because of, you know, standing up and doing what was right and doing the right thing for the country and doing the right thing for people who were being mistreated. I had no regrets for doing what I did, basically.
And
I just wish it would have turned out the way I wanted.
Yes, I think we can all agree with that, David. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I guess, Nathan Sassman, that same question to you. Any regrets?
Well, sir, you know, we differed with my brigade commander early on. So I was very outspoken in my opposition, and it wasn't something that came, you know, 2-3 years later. So there was... you know, there was a conflict almost immediately from with our relationship. At this point, no regrets. I needed to lay out what my situation was about. If there's anything I regret, it's that the commanding general, the brigade commander, and myself couldn't have all gotten in a room and just been able to have a discourse. But I think at that time their relationship was so fractured that we couldn't move forward in that fashion.
Can you tell us what you're doing now?
Right. I'm a high school athletic director and a head football coach out here in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And I also help run a small football seminars and camps business. So I'm just pouring myself into young people's lives.
If the name Nathan Sassman sounds familiar to Army football fans, well, there was a couple of – one particularly great season and one bowl game that everybody will remember. Nathan Sassman, good luck in your endeavors. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you, sir, for having me on the show.
Nathan Sassman, co-author of Warrior King, The Trial and Betrayal of an American Commander in Iraq. He earned a Bronze Star for Valor while leading the 1st Battalion of the 8th Infantry Regiment of the 4th Infantry Division in Iraq. He was with us today from Pan Studios in Colorado Springs. And let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Bob. Bob's with us in Virginia Beach.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
About 3 years ago, I wrote a book about my students. I teach at a community college. I've been doing so for more than 20 years. And I wrote a book called Prof, and it pretty much is an expose of the attitude and the problems in both the faculty and the students in the community college. And I think really representative of a lot of colleges really today.
And you name names?
Yeah, pretty much. It was clear. I definitely named the college. And I used first names and some last names.
So anybody really interested to learn could have figured it out.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, and they did.
And they did.
Yeah.
And what was the fallout?
Well, at first, the most difficult part for me was getting my classes to make because the word spread that my basic tone was one of contention. I was just very much the students were... It was all an attack on the students and the faculty who let the students get away with the junk that they do get away with in the community college today, from cheating to missing classes to grammar to everything. So the fallout from the faculty was a quiet kind of thing because they kind of agreed with me, except for the few that I mentioned who were very upset. The administration wasn't real pleased. But the students were the worst. It was, at first, for the first year and a half, it became somewhat difficult. A lot of the students didn't want to have anything to do with a professor who was going to make fun of them and attack them for their attitude and their methods in the college classroom today. Ironically enough, a lot of what I write about is me having a similar attitude when I was in college 25, 30 years ago. But
That part, I guess, people didn't focus on, but...
No, not at all, of course not. Your guest mentioned unanticipated consequences, and I think the biggest one for me is after my classes really started to make again now, the students are a lot more conscious of themselves in the classroom, and I didn't anticipate that, but they're like, well, a lot of people are offended by your attack on the student's attitude, and I basically gained a reputation that if you're offended by what I say, you probably deserved it. And and it was sounds a lot meaner than it was, but now my classes fill almost immediately, and I think the students are aware of the fact that I'm going to attack them for anything less than what's expected from a college student in a college classroom today.
So more than worth it, it sounds like.
In the end, yeah. It was, at first, there was that immediate kind of, oh, God, what did I do? One mm-hmm. of those type things. And that lasted for a little while. But in the end, it's kind of, okay, I'm okay. So.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Bob.
Thank you so much.
We're talking about the consequences of telling all. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And we turn now to Marina Rubin. Marina is a tutor for Potomac Tutors and wrote a tell-all cover story for the Washington City paper called Higher Education, H-I-R-E Education. She's managed to keep her job. She's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
How did you manage to tell a write-all about your workplace and still work there?
I checked with my boss first. I think that was key. And actually with the students in the article as well, which was maybe the part I was most nervous about.
Because obviously you were telling anecdotes, some less than flattering.
Exactly. And I was surprised to find that some of the students actually didn't really mind that they were being quoted. I had students who were saying things about how they thought Shakespeare was born in the 1950s. And one of my ninth grade students asked me if Native Americans were guys or girls. And I was really nervous about asking her if I could put this in the article. She looked at it, sitting there waiting for her, and... she looked up and said, oh, wow, that's me, and was just, I think, flattered by the possibility of celebrity.
Now, how long ago was this?
This was published in March, but I've worked at the same place for the past, this is my third year there, actually.
And have there been any consequences subsequently of people saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not sure, I want somebody tutoring my kid who might then describe it in the press?
Surprisingly, there haven't been consequences like that, at least not really in Potomac. I mean, people who are not affiliated with the tutoring company have had negative feedback, but I don't think many of my students or the parents there have seen the article. Maybe they don't read the city paper.
But in essence, you weren't criticizing the company or indeed your colleagues.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what's different in this situation from some of your previous guests. I wasn't really trying to expose something about the company. And really, I was just trying to paint a humorous picture of working there.
Mm-hmm. That is good advice, though. I guess if the situation allows for it, go ask your boss if it's okay if you write the book.
I think that's important if you want to keep working there.
And do you intend to keep working there?
I'm not sure if I'll be there beyond this year. I'm also teaching, at least this year, at a high school in Maryland, which is good for accumulating additional stories because it's a modern Orthodox Jewish high school.
And do they know of your proclivities for writing?
They did see the article. I'm not sure if that means that's why my students are saying more outlandish things, because they hope to be quoted, or if that's just their natural inclination.
So in your case, anyway, there's not really been that much of a price to pay, if any price.
No, surprisingly, there really hasn't. It's been good. I got to be on NPR. So.
Hey. And now you can tell. Well, anyway, the parents of the kids you tutor, what about them?
Yeah, I was nervous about revealing some of what I did, because I told some stories that weren't that flattering about parents who were kind of nasty. But again, I was more worried about the students.
These are, in short, your clients.
Right, exactly. And I was really worried more, though, about offending the students. I mean, as an educator, my goal is not really to expose their deficiencies. It's to help them. And so I didn't want to be pointing out that they were more interested in talking about yachts and Starbucks than their homework. But luckily, they didn't seem to get too upset.
Marina Rubin, thanks very much for coming in, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Marina Rubin, a tutor for Potomac Tutors and author of the tell-all cover story for the Washington City paper called Higher Education. You can find a link to it on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. She was kind enough to join us here today in Studio 3A. When we come back, we'll hear more of your stories about the effects of, well, what happened when you told all, and we'll also talk about the upcoming Sex in the City movie. Guys, if you need an official I can get out of seeing this picture with my girlfriend card, here's your opportunity. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about the tell-all memoir, the first-person expose, the blog that says too much about your colleagues and what it costs to publish them, and we're taking your calls. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. Here's an email we got from Laura. Dan Rogers refused to sail with the USS Scorpion in 1968. He later talked with a reporter about the tremendous maintenance problems on board that submarine. This information was researched and written about by Stephen Johnson, eventually becoming the book Silent Steel. Rogers felt tremendous guilt for surviving, as well as for breaking the oath of secrecy. He died as a result of bad health, mostly due to the stress of his inner struggle. That from Laura, the sister of David Stone, one of the crew members lost with 98 others on USS Scorpion in May 1968. Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Adrian. Adrian with us from Cleveland in Ohio.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I wrote a memoir that was published in January 2008, and I was a 26-year veteran of a renowned open-heart team here in Cleveland, Ohio. 2 weeks after my memoir was published, which I thought was about me, I was terminated from my job. I am a registered nurse, and apparently some of the things that I wrote about, I did not name names, but I think that the stark truth of my observations and perceptions and opinions resulted in my termination.
Did you name the hospital where you're working?
Yes, I did, because at the time I worked there.
And so you didn't think that was going to be controversial?
I did not. And perhaps I was naive in that regard, because I considered the book to be about me. And when it came out, the fact that other people in healthcare sort of aligned themselves with the book and some of the thoughts and feelings that I expressed, it became larger than me at that point.
And in the book, did you tell the names of surgeons or administrators who you thought were doing poor jobs?
I did not name names. I alluded to people, and this was over a course of many years. And actually, the depictions within the book are a compilation of a number of people, but a number of people also saw some similarities in perhaps the people that worked at this particular institution and in other nursing in other hospitals across the nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a certain culture in hospitals in the way that nurses and other healthcare members are treated, which I like to use Gore's term, a culture of impunity that exists. And apparently my book and my comments and observations are here at the appropriate time to bring those things to light.
Hmm. And in retrospect, are you glad you did it?
Yes, I am glad I did it. It's created quite a discourse. People are talking about it. Patients are talking about it. Other people that are in healthcare and outside of healthcare are talking about issues related to nursing shortages and, you know, how they're treated within the healthcare system. So, yes, I am proud of it. I will state again that what I thought was my memoir turned out not to be my memoir. And I think that's one of the unexpected consequences that your guest, Mr. Sussman, touched upon. Mm-hmm. I could not have anticipated that reaction. I knew I had a good book, but I thought it would be a slow roll to the New York Times bestseller list.
Right, and then the Pulitzer Prize, no doubt.
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. But I am proud of the work that I did, and I'm proud of the conversations that have been engendered as a result of the book. And no, I don't regret anything at this point.
Adrian, thanks very much for the call. Good luck.
Thank you, Neil.
So long. Here's an email from Justin in Boise, Idaho. While serving in Iraq with my Army National Guard unit in 2005, I kept a blog to keep family and friends back home in the loop with my own experiences and feelings. I was careful never to reveal information that would be harmful to our missions, but I did tend to rail against the commander of the brigade as out of touch and overbearing. I was told while in Iraq the commander was aware of my blog, but I felt I was justified in what I was saying, and I never said anything that could have been used against me as libelous or seen as seditious. However, as we were receiving our awards for serving, mine was conspicuously missing. It turns out that despite a stellar record and glowing recommendations from the high-ranking officers that I served with and protected every day, the commander, a general, denied my award. I saw the copy of the rejected award myself with the box checked deny and the general's signature. It still burns me up. And we'll end this conversation with an email from Rod in South Bend, Indiana. I had considered writing a piece online regarding a former supervisor of mine, a person who went out of his way to try to ruin my career out of personal dislike. I decided against it, thinking that it might come back to haunt me, as well as simply not wanting to stoop to that level. A month later, my supervisor's boss was fired. Fearing reprisal, my supervisor quit the following day. Sometimes karma is more fun. We'll talk about the Sex and the City movie coming up. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation.